Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is one of our all-time favorites, E.J. McMahon, who is an adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute and research director of the Empire Center for Public Policy, an independent nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank based in Albany, New York. He writes on regional, state, and local issues, recommending policy changes and reforms to increase economic growth. Welcome, E.J. Delighted to have you with us.
Hello, Alan. Thank you.
I think it's fair to say that you have been a critic of big-time spending, so why don't we start there? Are we spending too much?
Well, definitely. I mean, the governor wouldn't disagree with that. It's obviously, it's an odd and exceptional year, but I think it's helpful to review how the year started. In January, when the governor issued his budget, he, as usual, proposed a spending increase of just 2%, which to which he had to apply some gimmickry to hold it down to 2%, but he's generally been restrained in his percentage spending increases as governors go. On the other hand, having proposed a 2% spending increase, he had a pretty optimistic revenue projection for the year ahead at that point and going out multiple years. He was looking at pretty healthy increases in tax receipts across the board, especially the personal income tax, which is the state's main revenue source. Then comes the pandemic, but I would point out something that at the end of February, and if you go back, check your files, you'll confirm this. While we didn't know what the outbreak would be like here, and we're not prepared for it here in March, in February, concerns began to mount worldwide about the coronavirus emerging out of China. And there were growing concerns about the effect on supply and global supply chains. For many of us, it may have been the first time we heard so much mention of the phrase global supply chains, if you remember. The final week in February, the stock market crashed. It actually had a full-blown five-day fall that was officially what's called a correction. That is, the stock indexes fell 10% in a single week. Now, as it happened, that same week was the annual consensus revenue forecasting conference in Albany. This, again, is before the pandemic shutdown. Everybody's still holding meetings. And every year there's an economic conference to determine whether the revenue outlook is still what the governor said it was or whether the revenue estimate should be changed. Now, at the end of that week when the stock indexes fell 10%, and the newspapers were full of stories about mounting concerns about a recession and global supply chain disruption from the pandemic, the governor's budget director and the fiscal committee secretaries signed a statement agreeing that the state's tax receipts in the new fiscal year starting April 1st would be $700 million higher than the governor's original projection. $700 million higher. Yeah. Now you go into the next week and a half, and as everybody recalls, again, more and more is coming out now. Concerns are really mounting about the public health impact of the coronavirus and hitting the United States. I think it was March 2nd or 3rd that it was revealed and confirmed the first actual case in New York, which was the woman coming from Iran on the flight into the airport and all that, then the famous New Rochelle lawyer. Things begin to mount day by day. Nothing is said about the state budget. Now, Alan, you know, in Albany, March is crunch month on the budget. It's all about the budget. During March is when the legislature does its own one-house bills and when negotiations get serious. Well, as the coronavirus begins to come into play, there's no talk about the budget. Now, one might say, well, naturally, there was a distraction, but this had huge implications for the budget, and New York is unique. It's the only state with a fiscal year that starts as early as April 1st. Every other state with a couple of exceptions that are later in the year, every other state starts July 1st. Mm-hmm. So our budget was imminent in the midst of this crisis. Nothing is said about the budget. A reporter asked at some press conference very early on about the second week in March, well, there's just been a stock market crash, Governor. What do you think? And he's just begun the daily news conferences, and he says, well, who knows? He kind of shrugs it off. And I don't think, by the way, he did not understand the question. It was that he did not want to talk about it. Nothing much is said about the budget for a month, and then finally, by the end of the month, by which time the legislature is now meeting quasi-virtually. Remember, they came into town but stayed in their offices and didn't go to the floor. And what ends up happening is they adopt the governor's budget. They basically enact the governor's entire spending proposal, original spending proposal, with one major exception, which is that the federal government in the so-called CARES Act, which was the last major stimulus bill so far, had given states a lot of money, including money that in New York's case was $1 billion for what are called Title I schools, schools serving high poverty and disadvantaged populations. That money was fungible. That money allowed the governor that provided $1 billion in relief for the budget that replaced state money. But otherwise, what the state was spending was exactly what the governor had proposed spending before the pandemic. And he acknowledged this right up front. He had his normal press release the day the budget was passing, April 1st or 2nd. This is a great accomplishment. It's wonderful. We've done this. Flat out saying there's a $10 billion hole in the budget and the federal government better give us money to fill it because we can't. So we entered the fiscal year with a budget that knowingly spent $10 billion more than the state could afford. As we talk today, the state is almost halfway through the fiscal year. And the governor has begun to withhold parts of the spending in that budget because he had basically taken the risk of going out on a limb and hoping and actually, frankly, expecting and assuming that he would get enough aid from the federal government to plug the gap this year, which hasn't happened yet. Something may happen later this month, but nothing is for sure. So are we spending too much? Yes, the governor says we're spending too much, in effect, when he says he needs billions of dollars from the federal government to balance his budget. And we're also prospectively going ahead. The budget is unbalanced to the tune of, for next year, before you do anything else, next year's state budget gap is $17 billion, and the year after that is projected at $19 billion. And even adjusting for the size of the budget, that's about as big as it's ever been.
Now, I'm assuming that the governor, who has, in conversations with me and with the reporters and everybody else, has said, I know what I'm doing here. I'm waiting for the federal government to give us the money. But I'm assuming he also had, EJ, a plan. He had to have a plan of where that money was going to come from if the feds didn't give it to him.
I'm not sure he had a fully fleshed out plan. You remember the phrase of his father, spoken to you many times, he had no plans or plans to make plans. I'm not sure the governor would admit that in this case, but I think what his plan was, A, assume stopgap help from the feds. B, that the plan, and this remains the plan, the plan is Biden is elected and the Democrats capture the Senate. He actually said that yesterday. He's actually flat out said yesterday that he anticipates and assumes and plans on Biden being elected and the Senate being controlled by Democrats, which would mean some continuing increased aid in the future. Now, the one stopgap he did have this plan, which was a really notable thing. In the past, and under current permanent budget law, the governor can't, even if money is running short, the governor doesn't have the power to impound or withhold any money on the local assistance side of the budget. There's an old case going back to the Kerry era that determined that. The governor can squeeze state agency spending. He can turn it up and down like a spigot. He controls that. But the bulk of the budget, as you know, is local aid, and he can't impound local aid. But however, he got a provision in this year's budget. The legislature passed a provision saying that there's several different what we call reporting periods, but basically what it boils down to is that if revenues are coming in much far below projections and below last year's level, that the governor can restrain spending accordingly, and that after a certain point he can actually make permanent across-the-board cuts in spending if he notifies the legislature and gives them 10 days to do something different or to do it in a different way. Using that power, he has begun withholding chunks of local aid, and it's beginning now to actually be felt more tellingly because school districts are now beginning the school year in different patchwork ways, to be sure, and they are getting 20% less aid than they expected because of the governor's withholding of aid while he continues to wait and hope for some stopgap assistance from Washington in the next stimulus bill. So he has begun to slow down spending. He also announced, or rather confirmed, two different freezes in state employee wages. Actually, by the way, state employee wages have been frozen for those union members in the CSEA and some other bargaining units that expected to begin getting raises at the start of the fiscal year. Oddly, really oddly and strangely, there has been no formal statement, memo, or piece of paper of any kind has been issued by the Budget Division or the governor actually announcing that or explaining it. Basically, the unions have – it became public because the unions complained about it and then said various things about it, and the administration sort of confirmed it. So through September, there have been a freeze in state employee wages, and there's been a hiring freeze, which we'd think would be automatic in any case in this situation. So that's where we are. But the point is, when you go this deeply into a fiscal year and only start cutting after a few months, you have to cut that much more in order to deal with the situation. One other thing I'd point out is that special language that lets the governor unilaterally begin to squeeze money out of the budget says that he has to do it across the board. That's pretty clear. Well, that's a problem because school aid is very, very progressive and distributed on an income basis. In other words, the poorer districts depend much more on state aid than rich districts. When you do an across-the-board cut of 20% of any segment of school aid, that causes much more pain in poor school districts than in rich school districts. And that's what's beginning to happen now.
E.J. McMahon, are we seeing specific instances in which, for example, school districts are laying off 20% of their teachers because of a 20% cut?
Layoffs have been announced in various districts, some of them ahead of this, and we are beginning to see layoffs and program cuts announced. I would note, by the way, the one thing you're not seeing announced is any effort to try to get teacher unions to agree to wage freezes, nor has the governor ever announced any intention to seek a state law, which could be done, freezing public employee wages, because the item that drives school budgets is salaries, especially teacher salaries. In a typical district, typical teacher's contract between base pay and longevity steps, most teachers are entitled to raises of 3-5% a year. And yep. That is the number one factor pushing up school budgets. And amid the budget cuts that are beginning to happen, you don't hear any talk about how one reason the budget cuts are needed, to be sure in response to the aid cuts, is that the districts are paying salary increases to their teacher unions. But in any event, when you get to districts that are really heavily, like 60-70% dependent on state aid, I mean, a 20% cut is a pretty big deal. And so, yes, huge. You're seeing layoffs, you're seeing cuts. It's a huge deal.
So, EJ, you're a brilliant policy analyst. You have the advantage of saying this is what he's doing. What should he be doing?
Well, I would start the answer to that question with what should he have done. And I'm not just saying this in retrospect. I was writing it at the time. I think that he should have played it safer and actually cut, for instance, in the case of school aid, the budget itself should have had a school aid cut in it. And I think that many of the leading school management associations and groups, more than half, expected that to happen as the situation got darker in March, and were surprised when it didn't, because that would have at least provided for a fairer distribution of reductions, even temporary reductions. He didn't do that. So what's he need to do now? What he needs to do now is I think, and the thing that he really resists doing is he does not want to actually make deeper cuts in a way that would require to get the legislature to get involved, both because the legislature hates doing things like that in election year, although they now expect to be, at least in the Senate side, apparently coming back, but also because the two growing loudest contingents in the two legislative majorities don't want to do any cutting. All they want to do is increase taxes on a few thousand high earners. And he does not want to do that. And I would say, insert the word yet. He's not actually ruling that out. He's very conscious of the fact that if you do that now, you're doing it in an environment where there's no longer a federal deduction for state and local taxes, and where, by the way, we're not even sure how many of the highest earning New York resident taxpayers are still resident in New York.
So and whether they'll stay resident. Yeah.
Or whether they'll stay resident in New York. He's very leery of this for good reason, and he's made that clear publicly. So you've got a legislature that is utterly disinterested in controlling the budget. I think he would have had a better chance at getting some sensible opening cuts on the table if he had done it in the main budget in April. But as he also made clear, he was remarkably frank on this subject in his news conference yesterday. He wanted to do as little as possible, because if whatever he did, he thought would effectively be discounted by Congress in any aid bill to the state. In other words, if the state's problem could look less bad than he said it was, the state would get less money. So he's essentially doing done as little as possible up to now, as little as he could. He had to begin to restrain aid because he wanted Congress to see this problem as big as it was. The problem is, I'm not sure what Congress does turns either way on what people perceive about New York and Washington.
So, fascinating. I mean, all along, you're quite right, he has been saying, you've got to give us this aid, and I'm not thinking about anything else except that the aid you're supposed to be giving us.
Right.
Let me ask you something, EJ, a what-if question. If the Republicans right. still control the state Senate, would the mess we're in have changed?
No, unless the governor did something different. No. If the Republicans had been in the majority this spring with all that has happened, last year a lot of things would have been different. This year, I think nothing so far would have been very different, because the easiest course for the legislature was to rush through the budget session, pass a budget based on the governor's proposal, and split. And the Senate Republicans would have been as anxious and willing to do that as Senate Democrats. And it would have been the same old political dynamic as in the past, which is the Senate Republicans, given how their conference was distributed when they had the majority, would have had a critical mass of people worried about reducing aid to their school districts in Long Island, and that would have been a complicating factor. The other big difference, though, would be you would not have a critical mass in the Senate Majority Conference demanding enormous tax increases, actually several different enormous tax increases.
Is that going to happen?
Well, it's highly unlikely to happen this year. One of the favorite proposed tax increases from legislators on the left is the so-called billionaire wealth tax. That tax is completely impractical, and it's unconstitutional and won't happen. And there's nothing like it anywhere in the United States. There's only a few places in the world have tried it, and you abandon it. That won't happen, but that will continue to get talked about. There's several different competing proposals to increase the income tax on millionaire earners. And again, and this is where your question about the number of seats the Senate Republicans have is interesting. The governor clearly does not want to do that. And when it comes to taxes, in my opinion, he's the adult in the room insofar as he recognizes that, by the way, he's hardly a supply-side conservative when it comes to taxes. He's the guy, after all, who repeatedly extended the existing so-called millionaire tax rate starting his first year in office after saying he wouldn't do it. So it's not like he has a problem with doing that. The problem is he totally understands that everything is in flux, that a lot of the wealthiest New Yorkers are not here, at least temporarily right now, and that it's a very uncertain situation, that a lot of our more affluent taxpayers are people who hold well-paying professional and corporate jobs, who commute in from New Jersey and Connecticut, who now are not commuting in anymore, many of whom may decide not to begin to pay their New York State wage taxes after working at home for most of this year. There's all sorts of factors involved in this. So,
and they don't have to do that because they're not physically present in New York. Is that the rule?
The rule gets fuzzy. There's a so-called convenience of the employer rule. This is a very interesting, complicated subject. Because we were the first state in the region to have an income tax, Jersey didn't even have one till the late 70s, and Connecticut didn't have a tax on wages and salaries till the 90s. They came in late, and so they've always had to stand back and let New York tax be the primary state taxing the wages of their commuters to New York, and they give a credit for that tax on their tax. So as a New Jersey Treasury Department person once said to me, every morning we watch $2 billion cross the bridge into New York, which is how much in taxes they generate for New York State.
Sure.
Sure.
Now, it's one thing to have a rule where your boss kind of lets you work at home a lot of the time in Princeton, and your boss is in the city, and the understanding was you still had to pay taxes to New York because that's where your salary originated. This mm-hmm. situation where you're going to have people having worked, in many cases, from early March right through the end of the year in an increasingly comfortable, settled home office somewhere outside New York State, you're going to have people testing the approach and seeing if they can just be taxed by their home state. So that's another threat. That is lower than the multimillionaires, but very affluent people who generate a lot of taxes as a group. The multimillionaire group, the most popular tax proposal is to raise taxes starting at incomes of $5 million. Well, you know, there's only 6,700 or so households resident in the state that make more than that. So what happens there is, you do the math simply, a very small number of people in that group alter their income earning profile or leave the state, and a big chunk of whatever you thought you were raising goes with them. It's a really uncertain situation. The governor, in his own way, has kind of pointed to that, acknowledged that that's a problem. And remember, something that's constantly overlooked, even though the governor has talked about nothing else for a long time, at least before COVID, there's no longer a state and local tax deduction for all intents and purposes for people with incomes that high. So the effective cost, the effective tax price of New York for somebody who's got really high income and multiple residences, the effective price of being in New York as opposed to somewhere else is at its highest level ever, like higher than Rockefeller era. So yep. This is a dicey environment for him.
Now, Comptroller DiNapoli keeps talking about getting about $15 billion by reinstating the stock transfer tax. Is this something we should do?
Well, all taxes have consequences, usually including a lot of unintended consequences. That tax goes back to an era that technologically and in the size of the market and number of transactions in the stock market was primitive by current standards. It remained on the books as a sort of digital pantomime transaction ever since the 70s, because when New York City was falling into bankruptcy in the 70s, that was actually a New York City tax, not a state tax. It was essentially converted into a state tax and then made immediately refundable, because it was mentioned in bond covenants that it couldn't be taken out of. So that's why it exists. But it is still technically, quote unquote, paid, but immediately refunded. We don't know exactly how a lot of people involved in stock transactions and a lot of traders would react if they were suddenly subject to and had to pay that tax. We certainly know how trading now occurs, which is largely electronically and not tied to any physical place. So it's one thing to look at what that tax now theoretically raises and assume that you're just going to raise the same amount by reinstating it. The arguments for a stock transfer tax, which usually go like this, well, there is a tiny stock transfer tax in effect in various other Western countries, so what's the big deal? But the key word in that argument is countries. In other words, Britain has a stock transfer tax that applies in all of Britain, not just in London. We're talking about a stock transfer tax applying only in New York State, which could be evaded by finding ways to execute your trades in ways that weren't touched by New York State. It's, again, you have this industry that even now, even though it's the securities industry's employment in the state peaked a while ago and has been declining as a share of the total, you've got an industry whose continued operation and presence in the state, including the New York Stock Exchange, which physically is less important than it used to be. But you could be jeopardizing your status as a financial capital or undermining or further eroding the tax base. I guess the ultimate argument would be, why would you do anything that risks further eroding the part of the tax base you lean on most heavily?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the risk. I mean, this is not a time to be taking pronounced economic risks like that, I would argue.
Comptroller DiNapoli had a critical audit of the economic development projects, the so-called public-private partnerships. Many of these led to the corruption trials, Buffalo Billion, SUNY Poly, et cetera, and his aides in trouble. Many suggest this kind of economic development doesn't work. What do you think?
I think he's right. I think his audit is just the latest evidence demonstrating that these were boondoggles. They did not deliver as promised. It's not a good model. If there had not been any corruption, real or alleged, convicted or accused, it'd be a bad idea and a waste. We see that nothing is quite panning out in terms of how the Buffalo Billion segment was spent on the Tesla solar power panel plant. And to a varying degree, we're seeing that elsewhere. I think that that model that the governor has followed has been unsuccessful and certainly now should be abandoned.
The governor was not implicated, as we know, but his aides have gone to jail as a result of that. Any assessment as to whether this has hurt the governor?
I think that it's hurt the credibility of his policy. Again, quite apart from federal indictments or people going to jail or not going to jail or the governor's politics, it's a failed policy. It doesn't work. The governor has not admitted, by the way, if you listen to what the administration says, the Empire State Development Corp, which is his economic development arm, is a veritable happy talk machine. Nothing negative is ever acknowledged. But this model has not worked. That's the basic fact. There's no way he can credibly claim that it still works.
One last thing, yeah. EJ, and then we got to go. We're having a census, obviously. And I keep hearing, at least anecdotal stories, the census is not going well. If it doesn't go well, particularly in New York State, does that kill us?
I think that if it's not going well, it's not going well pretty much all over. I don't think it quote unquote, it's something to be concerned about. I don't think it quote unquote kills us because I think that attaches more importance to the number of congressional seats, say, than really matters in terms of the challenges we face going ahead as a state, fiscal and economically. The accuracy of the sentence of the census, unless it was way, way off, is not the major one. I agree that people, there's grounds for concerns, and I hear the same things you hear, but it doesn't kill us. What's going to kill us or what's going to damage New York for a long time to come is not a miscount on the census. It's the economic hole we're in and the fiscal hole we're facing.
Okay, EJ, I can't tell you how much this means to me. I've been hanging on to every word. You're a very knowledgeable guy. We're out of time. Our guest has been EJ McMahon, adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute and research director of the Empire Center for Public Policy, an independent, nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank based in Albany, New York. EJ, again, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Alan.
Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.